Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the fight over voting rights takes center stage in Washington. For the past year, Democrats have been touting two major bills aimed at protecting the vote in federal elections, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Now the push is on to bring the bills to the Senate floor, but passage rests on Democrats changing Senate filibuster rules, which now seems extremely unlikely. Richard Hassan is professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. He joined me this week to discuss the bill stalled in Congress and what other options are on the table to counter election subversion. Professor Hassan, Democrats are really pushing hard on two issues, voting rights and election security. How do you think they're doing? What did you think of the president's comments yesterday?
I thought the president's comments were too little, too late. This discussion should have happened over the summer. And in fact, a discussion on what I call election subversion, the risk that the election counting could be messed with in the future, is something so urgent that I had said last year that when Biden came into office, this is something that Democrats and Republicans should have tried to attack together. Remember, Mitch McConnell gave this impassioned speech against Donald Trump. There was a moment when more Republicans were willing to stand up to Trump and his attempts to undermine the election process, and that moment seems to have passed.
That moment was so brief because just within 2 days, it seems Mitch McConnell had changed his voice on that. But let's talk first about voter suppression. How much worse do you think it is now than, say, in that 2020 election?
It's really hard to say. First, the 2020 election was unique in that we were voting in the middle of a pandemic and much more voting by mail. Changes in voting rules, we changed the times of some primaries, you may remember, because it wasn't safe to go to the polling place. There were some changes that were made that made it easier for voters to vote that were put in place because of the pandemic. And some of what we're seeing in terms of laws in Republican states that are making voting harder are rolling back some of those changes. So, for example, more people voting by mail. We've seen more drop boxes. These are government mailboxes, essentially. They're used only for returning ballots. This was expanded. Voters like them. They're a secure, easy way. I voted using that right across the street, across the way from my library in my neighborhood. But in a number of states, they're now forbidding the use of these drop boxes or making them scarcer.
And on what grounds?
Well, so the claim is twofold. One, that they're necessary to prevent fraud, even though we did not see any serious instances of fraud with drop boxes or otherwise in the 2020 election. The other is to promote voter confidence, which is a really, it's a kind of bootstrapping by first undermining confidence in the election by making unsubstantiated claims of fraud, and then using the lack of confidence that you've yourself created as a basis to make it harder to vote. But to come back to your main question, if all that you're doing is some kind of rollback to where things were before the pandemic, I don't think that's necessarily going to make things much worse. But what I think we see happening is something else, which is that there's pressure from above, from Trump, and pressure from below, from the Republican base, to do something about the supposed scourge of voter fraud. Millions of Trump supporters believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen. And if you believe that claim, you're going to want your legislators to do something. And so some of what they're doing is the passage of laws that make it somewhat harder to register and vote. But I think it's important to understand. We don't know exactly how these laws will affect turnout. Sometimes they create a backlash effect and they don't affect turnout, or we can't measure it. Maybe even more people would vote if turnout doesn't go down. So it's a hard question. I think the better way of asking the question is, does the state have a good reason to make it harder for people to register and vote? Is there a reason to take away drop boxes? And so far, from what I've seen, the answer is no, that things worked very well in 2020. The reason things are being changed is for political reasons, not really to enhance the integrity of the vote.
It was interesting this week that Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition finally had a chance to talk to former President Trump. And before Steve could get to the question of voting rights, former President Trump hung up on him. How much is Donald Trump controlling the party as far as voting rights are concerned?
Well, I think he's having a tremendous influence and a tremendous negative influence in convincing his supporters that the 2020 election was stolen. Before this interview on NPR, Mike Rounds, who's a United States senator from South Dakota, said on one of the weekend talk shows that he thought that the 2020 election was fair and that Biden had fairly won the election. And Trump immediately attacked him. There is a price to pay for trying to stand up to Trump. One of the most disturbing statistics I've seen of the lots of polls that show that Republican voters believe the big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. But one of the most disturbing polls I saw was a CNN poll from a few months ago in which 59% of Republican voters said that believing that the 2020 election was stolen was an important part of what it means to be a Republican. That is, it's part of the identity. It moves the Republican Party much closer to a cult of personality than to one that is committed to particular ideological ideas like lower taxes or school choice or, you know, whatever issues Republicans might wish to stand on.
And former President Trump will continue to push that lie. Both these bills that would address many of these issues, they're stalled in Congress, in the Senate. How far do you think they're going to get?
So I think it looks at this point that it's unlikely that either the Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act are going to succeed and get to President Biden's desk. The reason for that, to be clear, is that although 50 senators, plus the tie-breaking Vice President Kamala Harris, although 50 senators support the bill, there are at least two senators, Senators Manchin and Sinema, who do not believe that there should be a tweaking of the filibuster rules, which require a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate to get certain kinds of bills through. They don't believe in changing the rules for voting rights. This is where the push is right now. This is why President Biden, in his speech this week, for the first time, I think, very directly said he believes that the filibuster rules should be tweaked somehow to allow for that vote to take place.
And what do you mean? What did he mean by tweaking?
So there are certain bills already that don't require a 60-vote majority. This is how the Build Back Better bill could get through. It's through something called reconciliation. Certain budget-related bills don't go through the filibuster.
Right.
Back when Democrats controlled the Senate, when Harry Reid was Senate Majority Leader, they changed the rules for nominations for judges and for executive office nominations to be a majority vote only, no filibuster, except for the Supreme Court. And then when the Republicans took over, the Republicans then changed that rule for the Supreme Court. And that's how we were able to get Justices Gorsuch, Barrett, and Kavanaugh through without a 60-vote threshold. So there have been changes, you know, over time. There have been changes to the rules for the filibuster. At one point, it was 67 votes. Now it's 60 votes. There are tweaks all the time. And it sounds like Biden is open to Senator Manchin's different ideas. One example is a talking filibuster, where you actually make the people who are trying to block the law have to speak, and until they run out of the energy to keep speaking. Another idea is lower the filibuster to 55, or allow one bill a year to get through without a filibuster. I think Democrats would take almost any of these if they would get the voting rights bill through. But Senator Manchin has said that although he believes that some changes in the filibuster rules might be desirable, he does not believe that these are changes that Democrats alone should enact. Right. So this is the other, it's an arcane point, but it's an important one. In order to change Senate rules ordinarily, you need 67 votes. That is, you need a two-thirds majority. The way that these earlier changes were made to the nominations rules was through the so-called nuclear option, where a bare majority of senators ask for a change. They appeal to the chair, in this case, the vice president, to say, can we pass this by a majority vote? And the vice president says, sure. And that's how they've been able to get around the rules. Now, both Democrats and Republicans have done it this way to get around the rules. But Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema of Arizona don't agree with doing that for voting rights. I mean, I've been saying that this needed to happen for voting rights. I think the first piece where I wrote that was back in 2018, before, you know, when we were well before the 2020 election. It's, if you can do it for budget rules, it certainly seems that you should do it for voting rights. But that's not the position that these two senators have taken. And so this is what I mean when I said to you earlier, too little, too late. If Biden had started last summer making speeches every week about voting rights, you know, kind of being like LBJ, who in the 1960s used his bully pulpit to push the Civil Rights Act and then the Voting Rights Act. If we had that, maybe there would have been enough pressure on them to make this change. But now we're already talking about the 2022 elections. The window for getting serious legislation passed in Congress in this divided era is really tough. And so it does seem like the moment is past.
Considering the range of the virus that was confronting not only this country, but the entire world, perhaps the president should be allowed a little slack on that issue, considering people weren't paying attention to anything that Congress was doing other than helping get rid of this virus.
Sure, but he did get an infrastructure bill through. So he did put his energy into that. And I think the thinking was, we're going to put our energy into the infrastructure bill and to the Build Back Better bill. We're going to show that Democrats can govern. And this is going to lead to such a surge in support for the Democratic Party that even if there is voter suppression, even if there are attempts to make it harder for people to vote, Democrats are still going to win their elections. And now we're in a situation where not only do we not have the voting bills, we also don't even have Build Back Better, because that too has been stalled by Senator Manchin. The problem is Democrats have the barest of majorities in the Senate, and they have a very narrow majority in the House. And so although they nominally control those branches, they can only go so far as their most conservative members are willing to go.
I wonder about your thoughts on Senator Manchin and why he is going against his own party to the extent he is.
Well, one thing to know is that Senator Manchin is from West Virginia. West Virginia, I think, went 42%, 42% more voters voted for Trump than for Biden. He's a conservative person. You know, I don't know. It's like when people ask me, well, you know, what's inside Trump's head? I don't know what's inside any of their heads. So we can only look at their actions. And he has a certain view as to how the Senate should function appropriately. And that seems to be the kind of the, there's some kind of stopping point for him where he's not willing to go further despite the pressure. And there have been some reports that all of the pressure that Democrats have tried to put on him has been backfiring. And of course, he's had entreaties from Republicans to come over. He's a pretty conservative Democrat. Could he become a Republican? He's saying he wouldn't. But that, of course, is the threat that hangs over all of this. If that happens, imagine that Joe Manchin decided tomorrow, you know what, I will caucus with the Republicans. Then what happens when Stephen Breyer, the 82-year-old justice of the Supreme Court, who passed over retiring last year decides to retire this year, and then Democrats can't get their votes to get a new nominee through, then you might have an 8-justice Supreme Court instead of a 9-justice Supreme Court with only 2 justices appointed by Democratic presidents. So things hang really by a thread, and there's only so far that Democrats can push Joe Manchin at this point.
How serious is it if Democrats cannot get this filibuster change through?
So what it means, assuming that the filibuster change does not happen, is that these laws are not going to pass. So it's going to be easier for states to pass laws that make it harder for people to register to vote. There's not going to be a meaningful constraint on partisan gerrymandering. There's not going to be improved campaign finance disclosure rules, rules that tell us, you know, who's behind the money that is trying to influence our elections. So there's a lot of stuff that won't pass. That alone doesn't mean the end of American democracy, but it does mean that in some places, mostly in some places controlled by Republican legislatures, that it's going to be harder to register and to vote. And that district lines that are drawn, and this is true in Democratic and Republican states where the redistricting process is a political process controlled by one party, there's going to be more districts that are less competitive, where it's going to be a clear Democratic or clear Republican district. There's not going to be a lot of competition. But this means that the battles have to occur state by state. And so the fights have to be about, you know, what's going to be in the law in Texas, what's going to be in the law in Georgia. Both of those states passed restrictive voting laws. But I have to say that the laws that were actually passed in those states were not nearly as bad as when they started, in part because there was pressure from the business community and others in the states to make them not as bad. And they go to the second point, the point you raised at the top of our discussion, which is about the danger of election subversion. We've been focused on voting rights, but what worries me even more than the assault on voting rights is the potential that the rules could be manipulated so that the loser of the election could actually be declared the winner. I every time I say it, I'm kind of amazed I'm talking about that in the United States, that this is even a problem.
And how could that happen?
So the presidential election is, in the United States, uniquely susceptible to manipulation because there are so many steps that happen between the time that voters go in their states to vote for president and the time that those votes are finally counted by Congress on January 6th after election day. And we saw Donald Trump try during the 2020 post-election period to try to get state legislatures to send in alternative slates of electors, to try to do certain things to try to manipulate the process, even to try and get the vice president to not accept validly cast electoral college votes in the states. And so this is a real concern of mine. But I do want to say that back to that Texas law, the original version of that Texas law included a provision that would have made it much easier for a state court judge to simply throw out the results of an election. It changed the standard of proof from clear and convincing evidence, which is a tough standard, to preponderance, just a more likely than not standard. It changed what you needed to show in terms of illegal votes that could affect the outcome of an election. That provision was stripped out of the final version, and I believe that was in part due to pressure from the business community within Texas. And so one of the things I argued in my recent New York Times opinion piece is that we need to think about this. Congress is not going to save us. We need to think about this as a national battle that we all have to face together, bringing together business groups, church groups, unions, lawyers groups, all of civil society. This is really what we need is a kind of mass movement to assure election integrity. Look, there are lots of things that a liberal Democrat and a conservative Republican are going to disagree on. But what I hope they would all agree on is the idea that we should hold an election where all eligible voters, but only eligible voters, can participate in an election where their votes will be fairly counted. I mean, that's really the basic minimum of democracy. And we may have to organize around that principle going forward.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Richard Hasson. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Richard Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. There is some fear from Republicans that what Democrats are asking for is a federalization of the voting process. Do you see it that way?
Well, it's not nearly as federalized as what I would like. Back in, I'm trying to remember now, in my 2012 book, The Voting Wars, I said that we should have federalized elections. We should have a national nonpartisan election administration body that actually runs elections. This is nowhere near that. But there are federal benchmarks that are put in these laws. So, for example, if a state passes a law that imposes a voter identification requirement, it would be considered by the Justice Department to make sure that it does not make minority voters worse off in terms of their ability to cast their votes. It would impose national standards in terms of gerrymandering, making it harder to draw congressional districts that favor one party over another. So there certainly are provisions in there that put a greater federal role in elections. But the Constitution is clear. In Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution, it says states can set up rules for running congressional elections, but they're always subject to congressional override. That is, Congress has the power to come in and say, this is how we want you to run federal elections. And let me point to one change that I think would be a great change on the federal level. In the Freedom to Vote Act, which is one of the two bills we've been talking about, there's a provision that says that everyone should vote on voting machines that produce a paper ballot that can be recounted in the event of an election dispute. And about 11-12% of voters in the United States vote on wholly electronic voting machines. Just imagine the Georgia conflict when President Trump was claiming that the Georgia votes were fraudulent. They did a hand recount of every single ballot in Georgia. If you only had a voting machine, a computer that tells you what the result is, can you imagine what someone who wanted to call into question the integrity of that vote, what they would say about the hacked software, whatever they would say? If there's a piece of paper that ultimately can be counted, that's the best safeguard against that sort of attempt to undermine confidence in election results.
Is there a resistance among the 11 or 12% voting areas where paper ballots are not present to introduce paper ballots?
Well, you know, it's very expensive and difficult to change voting technology. Where I live in Los Angeles County, it took them about a decade to come up with new voting machines that they felt would satisfy all the requirements. And even then, there's controversy about them. So we decentralize this. We let counties make the decisions or states make the decisions as to what the voting machines are. They have to meet certain federal standards if they're going to get federal funding. So I think that there would be a way to either outlaw them or to create enough financial incentives to get those jurisdictions that still use them to get rid of them. But, you know, that's the kind of change that really should not be political. It's not a Democratic or Republican, you know, voting machine. It is just, are you going to have something that's going to accurately record people's votes and that can be recounted by a court if necessary, if there's a dispute over an election? But you're right that sometimes this dispute gets framed as a state power versus federal power. Well, you know, the federal government can't tell me what to do in terms of how I'm going to run my elections. Well, in fact, the Constitution says that when it comes to congressional elections, that the federal government can tell the states what to do. That's the same basis that we have a law that was passed in 1993 called the National Voter Registration Act, or the Motor Voter Law, that says that every government office that offers services to voters, like the DMV or social welfare office, they have to offer opportunities to register to vote. That's the for congressional elections. That's the federal government using the power that is in the Constitution to say, here's how you have to run congressional elections.
There were a number of questions raised about various races around the country. Were any of them in regard to Republicans and whether they had actually won their races?
I don't think that we've had in the 2020 election, I'm not aware of any races, congressional races, Senate races, certainly not the presidential race, where the results have been called into question. We've had isolated instances of fraud. You may have heard of The Villages, which is a retirement community in Florida. I think there have now been three or four cases of people who've been accused of committing fraud, such as by voting the ballot of their deceased spouse. I think in all of these cases, the voters were supporters of President Trump. But the important thing is that they're isolated cases. If you're trying to swing a presidential election, or even if you're trying to swing a congressional election, it's quite difficult to do, and it's easy to spot. And so, in fact, in 2018, we did have a race for Congress in North Carolina, the North Carolina 9th Congressional District, where there was evidence of an attempt to tamper with absentee ballots. And that attempt was discovered, and the election board did not certify the results, and there was a new election that was called. So when problems do occur, and that's the only instance in a congressional election or any kind of statewide election, you know, any major election I can think of the one we'd have to go back to before that would be in the 1990s for kind of a major race. That was the Miami mayor's race, where there is an attempt at fraud on such a large scale. It's just very hard to pull off. So it's not, and the penalties are quite high for messing with vote totals. So I don't think that fraud in elections is a major problem. Certainly we need to keep putting resources into it so people are deterred from trying to do bad things, but it's not a major problem.
I want to go back for just a moment to the filibuster and Senator Manchin's argument that we should, in fact, have people stand up and continue to talk as they filibuster. If Democrats were to accept that, is there any reason to believe that Manchin would then vote for that change in the filibuster rules?
I don't have any inside information, but according to the reporting I've read, they've offered Manchin kind of any change that he would like, and talked to him about Senator Robert Byrd, who was a senator also from West Virginia, who was one of the leaders of the Senate for many years, who himself was kind of the master of the rules, and how Byrd himself was willing to make changes to the rules in the Senate and trying to appeal to him in that way. I don't know if there's anything that would appeal to him, but Democrats have been working on him for months. You may remember that just before the Senate recessed in just before Christmas, there was a break because Manchin was not satisfied with all the provisions of Build Back Better, and he was backing out of a deal, and Democrats were really putting pressure on him on that, and apparently some other Democratic senators were talking to him about the need to make these reforms. But just this week, Manchin suggested he was not willing to make those changes unless there was Republican buy-in. And there does not appear to be, even if you look at the most potentially cooperative Republican senators. So take Senator Murkowski, for example. She is the sole Republican co-sponsor of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. We've heard nothing from Murkowski about agreeing to filibuster reform. So I just don't see where that movement is.
Well, then back to the president's speech this week. Do you think, though you said it was too little, too late, do you believe he may have changed any minds whatsoever?
I don't. If you're talking about the minds of the two recalcitrant senators, I surely doubt that the public speech is going to make a difference. I think it's probably better to see this as an attempt by Democrats to shore up their base and say, we do care about voting rights. We're going to make this a priority. And, you know, whether that works well or not, I don't know. As you know, President Biden's approval rating has been low. And I think a big part of the reason for that is not that Republicans or independents dislike him. although that was true of Republicans before, but that Democrats see that Biden is not delivering. And if he's not delivering on voting rights and not delivering on this big package, it's going to be very hard to convince Democrats that they should continue to turn out and vote. And so I think that this speech was much more of a political speech that was aimed at the Democratic base of voters than it was really aimed at trying to convince Senator Manchin or Senator Sinema to make a change.
But isn't he, in a sense, trying to ratchet up expectations that he can get voting rights passed?
Sure, yes, but that's a very dangerous game to play. If you ratchet up the expectations and then you fail, then you look like a weak leader. And that's why, just before the speech, I posed the question on Twitter, and many people had different responses. Why would President Biden do this now, knowing, because we know the statements from Senator Manchin, that this looks pretty hopeless right now? And most of the responses from people who seem to know what they're talking about is that this is really about the 2022 elections more than anything else. That the time to have tried to move this was earlier. But as you say, we're in the midst of a pandemic. There are lots of other priorities. Biden wanted to show some legislative victories, not just some process victories. You know, assuring voting rights is not something that you can look at and say, this has made my life better, right? Even though if there are voting restrictions, you can certainly look at that and say, this has made my life worse. But things like the child care tax credit or, relief for people who are unemployed because of the pandemic, this is the kind of stuff that understandably Democrats wanted to focus on, but they've done so somewhat at the exclusion of focusing on elections and voting.
So if you could speak directly with President Biden right now, what would your advice be to him?
It's really hard to say what to do right now. Certainly, I think the most important lever for protecting voting rights within the executive branch is in the Justice Department. And of course, the president has said that he's not pressuring the Justice Department. So I guess it'd be better to speak to Merrick Garland and say that what you need to do is to, first of all, hold responsible those who tried to undermine the results of the 2020 election, including President Trump, if it's appropriate to go after him. And I think there's a lot of pressure on Garland for that, but also to be filing lawsuits. And they've done some of this, but pretty modestly so far, going after the most egregious attempts to make it harder to register to vote and to vote. Of course, part of the reason that there's a tough slog with the Justice Department bringing these suits is that the courts have become increasingly hostile to voting rights. So we've seen the United States Supreme Court in cases as recently as this summer in the Brnovich case, making it harder to use the Voting Rights Act as an effective tool to go after attempts to make it harder to vote. But we're in a really tough situation. What I would probably say to President Biden is we're hearing some noises now on the Republican side about changes to the Electoral Count Act, which is this old law that governs how Electoral College votes are handled by Congress. We're hearing some noises from Republicans about agreeing to make some changes there. If you can get the voting rights bill passed, great. But if you can't, this looks like an opportunity to try to find some bipartisan compromise to somewhat limit the chances that the next election will be subject to manipulation. So, maybe take that partial bipartisan deal, assuming you can't move Manchin and Sinema to get the larger voting rights package through.
And what would that do as far as the Electoral College is concerned?
Well, there are a number of different proposals out there on what Electoral Count Act reform would look like. But one of the things it might do is say that, first of all, confirm that the vice president doesn't have the unilateral power to simply throw out Electoral College votes, which is something that Trump was trying to convince Pence to do. But another thing would be to make it harder for objections to be raised to Electoral College votes, as we saw objections raised to the Electoral College votes from both Arizona and Pennsylvania, despite all the evidence that the elections were conducted fairly in those states. You could also make it harder for state legislatures to try to send in alternative slates of electors and claim that these electors are legitimately representing the choice of the state. And one possibility that has been floated out there is federal court review when there are disputed slates of electors. And you know, then the question is, do we want to get the courts, and is it appropriate for the courts to be involved in resolving those disputes? So there are a lot of ideas on the table, and I don't know that necessarily there's consensus on exactly which ones. But I think if the door is open for a good faith discussion between Democrats and Republicans, and that's a big if. Many Democrats believe that Republicans are only floating this as a way to distract from the attempt to try to pressure Manchin to pass the voting rights bills. But if there is a legitimate opening, then I think Democrats should take it.
So between now and the 2022 elections, do you see anything happening on either voting rights or election security?
I think that the next few weeks will be the tell. Biden's now come out, done the speech. There's going to be, every time Joe Manchin comes out in public, there'll be questions about it. It'll be pretty clear whether there's any movement very soon. And we hear that behind the scenes, Senator Angus King of Maine has been talking to Democrats and I believe some Republicans to try to get Electoral Count Act reform on the agenda. So I don't want to say I'm optimistic, but I'm hopeful that there's something can be salvaged in the voting area over the next few months before we fully enter the 2022 election season.
Thank you, Professor Hassan.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Richard Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He's the author of Election Meltdown and a forthcoming book, Cheap Speech, How Disinformation Poisons Our Politics and How to Cure It. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email via podcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Denhauser. Thanks for listening, all. Please take care of yourself and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.